so many priests would have believed and probably practiced, you know, for example, in confession, given absolution. And so in a sense, I think he was picked upon as an example, because that's often used by authority, like we'll pick on somebody as a warning to the rest of you, you'll end up like that too. And it's a very unjust way of administering justice. You know, it's scapegoating, really. And the scapegoating is just wrong. And it's unfortunate. It does happen in the church, as in every other institution, but you would expect less of it in a church that's founded on the teachings of Jesus Christ. And it's very wrong, the way the whole system works. And it's very frustrating, really, I think. You know, what way, if the Pope does give a pardon to the other priests as well, because you can't just single out one, and without reforming, you know, the Curia especially, the way they treat people over there. And it's going to be a difficult one when the Pope comes, because we will certainly be trying to challenge that in whatever way we can too when he comes.
I mean, when he comes to visit, you'll be asking him to take a look at these issues. Yeah, and what issues do you think are the ones that tend to be the most offensive, or the ones that are most likely to attract attention? Because, you know, he's looked at a couple of things, like the role of women in church, and you know, a lot of people have spoken about women's ordination or married clergy, or just the role of priest in general. I mean, which aspect do you think they are most resistant to changing?
I think at the heart of it is the clericalism, and that priesthood is the basis of clericalism. And I would think we would need a synod, a complete on priesthood, because it wasn't really touched much on the Second Vatican Council. Because, as you know, in the Second Vatican Council, when they were discussing the church, the first draft was a continuation from the First Vatican Council, the Pope at the top, bishops and the lay people. And there was a complete disagreement. And in the end, the way it worked was, there was the first chapter was the people of God. And then we had the different sections of it. And I think we'd want the same with priesthood. That there's, you know, in Peter's letters, we say, you are a royal priesthood. So we start off in the basic. We are all priests, right? Some of us are selected or chosen to be presiders of the Eucharist. How is that to be done? And so all of that has to be teased out. And in that process, then, it would mean that everyone is equal, because the priesthood is equal. You know, the royal priesthood, it concerns men, women, we're all equal. And then the presiding, the people who are selected or put themselves forward, can be either men or women. And I think a lot of women, certainly in the present setup, do not want to be a part of this clerical setup. And so we need a radical change of thinking on priesthood. And that is the only way. We start at the not at the top, but at the bottom. We're all priests, and then some have... And then you could say, even as a presider, it has been suggested, you could maybe for a year, maybe 2 years, and then you retire and you hand it over to someone else. So this idea, you're a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, it's some obtuse bit from the Old Testament that has no one seems to know what it means. So it has been always said that you have your change of essence of the person, and it needs to be reassessed.
But I suppose in any organization, I mean, if somebody was questioning the fundamental tenet of priesthood and what a priest is and what a priest can and can't do, I mean, any organization would have trouble with that if it were even a barrister or a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, a teacher or whatever.
Yes, of course, because the initial reaction is defensive. Here is someone challenging basic part of our organization. But we're moved ahead, and now we're actually given legal protection to whistleblowers. that the, you know, the person who actually speaks up and says, look, there's something radically wrong here and you should listen to me. So in this year of, you know, of 500 years since Martin Luther, you know, everyone said, oh, we should have listened to him, and we wouldn't, and we certainly wouldn't be in the situation we are today. So people like Tony Flannery, not just him, but everyone who is speaking out, they should be listened to. And they are challenging. And so that's what life is. It's the church is not a big club and uses the club against a person. Get down, stay quiet, shut up. We want to get on with life. That it has to be, you know, we have, someone says, isn't it in Latin, ecclesia semper referendum est. The church always must be always reformed. And that's a basic part of our thinking. And it doesn't happen. Remember, 50 years ago we had a Second Vatican Council and it was never implemented. And so in senses is we have to rethink. And otherwise the church is disappearing. Mm. And people like Tony Flannery, they see that and they're trying to ask archbishops and cardinals to do something. Listen to people. Change things that can be changed. Okay, we'll keep unity in essential items, but in unessential, there's freedom. And that's always been. Yeah. But, you know, we have tended over the last few, you know, popes, we have become this, is inessentials have become essentials. And no one seems to know which is which.
Well, I was just about to ask you that question. I mean, where does the line, one person's essential is another person's inessential?
Yes, that is true. And well, we would say is, well, what is the basic teaching or doctrine? Is the Nicene Creed, right? And so there you go back then to the Gospels. How far back do you go? Do you go back to the Council of Trent? You know, and as you say, is, but at the same time, all teachings must be based on tradition and on the Gospel. And that has to be, and if it's not, it should be, has to be challenged. And certainly the way of treating priests in the congregation of the, or theologians in the congregation of the faith, that is certainly not based on gospel value.
But, I mean, people argue the toss over that, don't they? I mean, they would, you know, say even ordaining men only, people would say, well, Christ chose only men, and therefore that makes sense that we only have men representing Christ. And, you know, people will find their gospel backup for whatever argument that they have.
Yes. The problem I always find still among priests, and especially on a Sunday homily, right through Christmas, everything is accepted exactly and is said to you, the angel was there and all of that. And we know, certainly from modern theological and biblical exegesis, that a lot of that was, it didn't happen, but it has a meaning in itself. And so I would think, going back to, you know, if we're going to argue what is essential, the essential thing is obviously God exists and that he sent his son, and we must believe that he is the Son of God. Believe in that, and he is equally a human being. And really that is the essential. And the Holy Spirit, obviously, there is a Trinity, and one is a community of love between, you know, these persons in the Trinity. And that's really the basic part. And We've enough to be, all these laws have been, we have a baggage of nearly 2,000 years, and it has to be sorted out some way. And each time Pope Paul VI, he couldn't cope with it. And then we had even Pope Benedict, he couldn't cope with it either. And so Francis is the same. He's coming up against stone walls, against, you know, this medieval structure that's there, and it's very difficult to change. And he did say to, about 2012, he did say to a group of Latin American superiors, he said, if you get letters from the Congregation of the Faith, just ignore them and get on with life. But that's easier said than done, because if you get a letter to say that you're being silenced, you can't ignore it.
I mean, what are the potential repercussions now that, you know, Father Tony Flannery has broken his ban, and, you know, for other priests who are getting those letters, what's their worry about the repercussions?
I think we've gone beyond the repercussion. Technically, will be excommunication. Now, that meant a different idea back in the Middle Ages, or Martin Luther, that it was, if you were excommunicated, you were in danger of death because no one was going to protect you. But it's meaningless in today's world. But it just means technically that, you know, he's excluded from the Catholic Church, whatever that means. And already other priests. There's a priest in America who has worked with women priests who have ordained themselves, and he has been excommunicated. But it doesn't bother him. He just gets on with life. So technically he could be, but it's not going to solve anything really in the long term. And the church, in the meantime, will continue on with this, and church is just falling apart. Young people are ignoring it, and so we have an interesting meeting now. In 2 months' time, we have a young person, and happens to be my daughter. She's going to address us in We Are Church on why the church is irrelevant to young people. And we should be listening to people like that. And to say is, why do you think it's irrelevant? And we have all fancy ideas, but we want to listen to people at the bottom. Why this church of ours that we all love, why is it just irrelevant to young people who are, you know, no more different to us when we were growing up, except now I think they're more honest.